Welcome to the Bovey UK podcast, where we will be discussing diseases from diagnosis through to management. These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon.
So for today's podcast, we have Fergus Allerton back on with us to discuss antibiotic course durations and their significance. For those of you that don't know Fergus, he is a graduate of the University of Bristol and completed a residency in internal medicine at the University of Liège in Belgium. He is also a diplomat of the European College of Veterinary Medicine, and he's the current editor of Companion and the BSAVA formulary. Fergus is actively involved in veterinary antibiotic stewardship and contributed to the development of the Protect Me guidelines, with a new version launching very soon. Within the European Network for Optimisation of Veterinary Antimicrobial Treatment, he is also working on recommendations for antibiotic use for surgical prophylaxis. So, welcome Fergus. Firstly, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today, as clearly you're keeping yourself very, very busy.
No, it's brilliant to be here again, and I'm looking forward to it, because I think antibiotic courses, it's something that we hopefully can answer even better in a few years' time. So,
yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're thrilled to have you back on here with us. So in the podcast today, we're going to be specifically discussing the importance of antibiotic course duration and how this is decided, touching on a current study in which veterinary surgeons, if you're listening, you can actively get involved with yourself. This is just a small topic within the issue of tackling antimicrobial resistance, but certainly one of high importance. So, Fergus, are you able to start by telling us what is the basis for current antibiotic course durations in dogs and cats?
Well, I think unfortunately it's somewhat arbitrary, and we tend to reach for the number of tablets that is familiar. So it might be the size of the pack. There are 10 tablets in a pack, so we're going to use 10 tablets, whether that's a 5-day course or a 10-day course. If we might make it easy and say, we'll give you a week's worth or 2 weeks worth. So we're using either Constantine units or multiples of the numbers of fingers we have on our hands, which is nothing to do with the bacterial condition we're actually trying to treat. And I think that it would be amazing if we could start asking the questions, what is the optimal course duration for any particular indication? So how long should you go? Should you go till the animal's better, or till there's bacteriological cure? And is there a difference in these sort of durations? So, yeah, at the moment, the evidence base for all our recommendations is empiric. It's either what we're used to or what a group of people have said, that sounds reasonable to me. And I hope that A, we can make those courses shorter, and B, we can do it with an evidence base that means that we can be confident that they are efficient, the right length of antibiotic treatment.
Absolutely. And is it possible to infer sort of anything from human medicine in terms of what the data that they're using for their evidence base? Is that something that we can apply within veterinary medicine as well?
I think so, yeah. Why not? They've been through the same processes, really, where, again, they didn't have the evidence, so they would come up with arbitrary course lengths. And historically, we all remember that you would go to the doctor and one of the key things they would say to you is always finish the course. And it gave that aura to that course length as though the doctor had carefully tailored that to you as a patient. And they were going to make sure that you needed that last tablet to really ensure that you would be cured of that problem. And I think that that doctrine is probably changing in human medicine as well. And they are now saying, treat until you're better. And they're trying to work out how long that is. And it may be that some people get better before the end of the course. And this is maybe an opportunity to flag our previous podcast where we talked about the antibiotic amnesty. So if you are better, you're not needing to use those antibiotics, return them to the pharmacy. Don't hold on to them and use them or throw them away inappropriately.
Yeah.
And there's some great work coming out of America on the human side. And that's largely led by a guy called Brad Spellberg. And he's created a table of studies. And he's found all the randomized control studies, which is the highest level of evidence you can get in human medicine, that have compared short versus long courses of antibiotics. And this is for a whole range of conditions, including things like pyelonephritis, osteomyelitis, septic arthritis, community-acquired pneumonia. So common conditions where antibiotics are warranted, but where people haven't known how long they should treat for. And when he's collated all these studies, what he's found is that outcomes for patients are no different between the short and the long courses. And he finds that over and over again. And now he's got this table that says shorter is better. Well, actually, shorter is the same as the longer courses in terms of outcome, and is therefore better because it means less antibiotics going into patients, going into the environment, and contributing potentially to AMR. So I hope that we can adopt a similar philosophy in veterinary medicine, and we can say if shorter courses are adequate, effective, better in human patients, surely that's going to be true in cats and dogs as well.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, it sounds incredible that someone, I can't imagine how much time it's taken him to put all that together. It must have been quite a feat of work. Is that something that we could then take forward into veterinary medicine, or would we have to sort of collate our own evidence in terms of sort of specific veterinary cases?
Well, I think the message is there, and one that we should certainly consider, check, and see if that does apply to the species we're treating. I would love it if we could make a table with multiple randomized controlled trials in veterinary medicine, but I fear that at the moment those sorts of studies are rare, and certainly on the antibiotic course duration ones, there really aren't that many that we could include in those types of tables. And so we need to start generating that evidence base. We need to start saying, as a profession, we are going to build that body of evidence so that hopefully we can demonstrate the non-inferiority, the efficiency of these shorter courses to reassure vets that they're not suboptimally treating their cases, their animals. And hopefully then people will adopt those shorter courses, and that will serve to reduce antibiotic use in a safe and appropriate manner.
Absolutely. And just touching on what you just briefly said about just about not necessarily finishing all antibiotic courses. I worked as a veterinary nurse, and we know all about sort of educating owners and the importance of telling them these things. So when is it that we shouldn't be encouraging them to finish courses? And would this mean that an infection would go untreated, or is there certain cases where this is appropriate?
I think that this is very much veterinary dependent or clinician dependent. And ideally, we will not be giving out unduly long courses. But there are situations where people might anticipate a chronic course of antibiotics. Now, I think that these are few and far between. And so we shouldn't really be prescribing antibiotics for extended periods without very, very good reason. But I think that there are instances where you might say, let's review this and see whether you need a course extension after a week, something like that. Maybe if you're treating something like cholangitis in cats or dogs, then you could say, let's try a week or 2 weeks of therapy. And if that's working and it's effective, we may feel that it's necessary to continue it and extend it a small amount, or we may be able to stop at that point. So I think incorporating that review phase in any extended course of antibiotics is vitally important. And some skin conditions, pyoderma, really the key is to identify the underlying trigger. What's actually making these animals susceptible to likely secondary bacterial infections? And that hopefully is something that we can treat and address. But in some instances, it's going to be challenging, and we might need extended courses of antibiotics to protect that patient while we get on top of their underlying disorder. And I think if you are going to do that, probably we still as vets want to be in charge of making those course cessation decisions. So we would encourage owners to come back and review that during the treatment course and then make a sensible decision to extend it. There's some really interesting work that's come out of human hospitals. And we all know that in a human hospital, it's unlikely that one doctor is going to be able to manage you if you stay in that hospital for a while continually throughout your time in the hospital. So your care will be shared by multiple people. And doctors, just like us, I think, are nervous to change a winning team. So they go in, they assess that patient, and they say, he's on antibiotics already. I'm going to continue those antibiotics because he seems to be getting better. And it's really hard to be the person who stops that treatment course. And so what they've suggested is actually, instead of having to make it a decision to stop, they have to make a decision to continue. So they force this antibiotic continuation review at set points. So it's actually almost an action to continue rather than a big step to stop. And I think that we can introduce some of these ideas in the way that we manage cases. I think I'm always cautious giving too much of that responsibility to pet owners, because ultimately we want to make those decisions with as much information and as much sort of informed decisions as we can. And so I think in the human side of things, it may become easier to say stop when you're better. In veterinary, I think that's probably a recommendation that we're going to have a slightly greater oversight of.
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's perfectly said. And I suppose something like culture and sensitivity, I assume that plays a massive part as well of these decision-making processes as to when to perhaps stop an antibiotic course if actually it's now deemed ineffective against what we're trying to target.
Very much. And I think that I'm always a fan of recommending cultures or cytology to try and demonstrate the presence of bacteria, demonstrate the presence of concurrent inflammation. So make sure it's actually a true infection and not a commensal that we're trying to treat. So if we can use those, we can use that again in the monitoring. So is there now no evidence of bacteria? Have we achieved a bacteriological cure? And in some frustrating conditions, that's what we need to demonstrate to avoid immediate recurrence when we stop the treatment. So I think that those are useful tools. And you're right that there will be cases where we find that the AST result contradicts our initial empiric choice. But I would say, trust what you're seeing in the pet. So if they're getting better with your treatment that the in vitro result suggests may not be effective, remember that that in vitro assessment is not always an accurate reflection of the way the antibiotic will work in the pet. So I would always say, if it seems to be working, you could justifiably continue, even if your AST result didn't seem to support that. And there's some great work actually coming out of the University of Copenhagen, and Luca Gardabassi has been looking into whether you could treat effectively some MRSP infections with drugs like amoxicillin, clavulanic acid, or cefalexin, because they found that some of them, classified as methicillin resistant, would still respond in vivo to those beta-lactam antibiotics. So it's sort of a surprise, because we would have expected resistance, and yet those animals seem to respond. So do judge how it's working in the animal in front of you, and don't just make a change because the piece of paper tells you that that might be necessary.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And coming back to the actual course duration itself, in terms of not even just the clinical case, sort of, we're talking about the environment around us and everything like that, why is course duration so important, and why are we discussing this during AMR week?
Well, I think that there is an impression that, well, we know that antibiotic use is a principal driver of antibiotic resistance. So the more antibiotics we use, the more resistance. And it seems logical that if you use 2 weeks where you could have used 1 week, that's a week's unnecessary antibiotic going into the environment. And it's not just your target bacteria that are affected. So you may be treating a urinary tract infection, very reasonable thing to do to reach for antibiotics in that context. But you are affecting the microbiome and potentially generating resistance mechanisms within the gut of that individual. Now, if they then shed those resistant bacteria, and given that we share lots of bacteria with the pets that we live with, then you may end up being a carrier of MRSA and MRSP, well, MRSA in people, MRSP in our pets, we may end up carrying some of these multi-resistant E. coli's. So we could contribute to the selection for resistant strains of bacteria. And I think in doing so, we make that environment more dangerous to all of us.
Absolutely. So I know you gave some pretty terrifying statistics on your last podcast, but what are we sort of looking at, for those that haven't listened to our previous podcast, what are we looking at in terms of the next few years? What are we looking at that's to come, and what is this threat, and how big is this threat?
Well, antibiotics have saved countless lives. They're brilliant and a really useful tool. But veterinary medicine, like human medicine, is developing amazing technologies and treatment options to treat some of the most challenging conditions. So we are seeing dogs with cancers being treated with chemotherapy and having a greatly extended quality and quantity of life. We're seeing dogs that have crippling locomotor issues having replacement joints, or, I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, you can probably tell, clever stuff done to their legs to fix them and render them mobile again. But those procedures, while not tackling a bacterial problem, they often rely on effective antibiotic protection and prophylaxis. So if you use chemotherapy, it's common that animals and people will become myelosuppressed. They will be neutropenic and therefore at risk of secondary bacterial infections. Now, most of those we can treat with the routine antibiotics we use on a daily basis. But maybe not in the future. If it meant that every time you had chemotherapy and you end up myelosuppressed, you were going to get a deadly multi-drug resistant infection, we wouldn't do the chemotherapy in the first place, and these diseases would become much more serious than they are currently. We wouldn't be able to say go down and have a total hip replacement, because the risk of them developing an MRSP or an MRSA infection would be so high that we wouldn't feel that it's worth putting them through that first procedure. So I think that we want to keep these tools effective for us. And yes, there are horrific statistics as to what could happen in the future in terms of mortality, and talks of by 2050, we could be looking at 10 million people per year dying directly due to multi-drug resistant infections. That probably won't affect the world equally or proportionately. It is going to really affect people living in low and middle income countries much more drastically than it does people living in more developed nations. And I think we have a responsibility, because the greatest problem comes from antibiotic use in people. But we are prescribers. We are using these tools to treat the animals that we see. And we need to do so in a responsible way to try and be part of that solution. And I also think there's knock-on effects of that. You say to your client, hang on, I'm not going to give you antibiotics for this acute diarrhea because they're not essential. They're actually... your dog's going to get better just as quickly without them. And they say, it's funny you say that. I had exactly the same conversation from my doctor when I went in for my cough a few days ago. And we're reinforcing what they're hearing there. And hopefully together we can start making some headway in reducing AMR.
Yeah, I suppose, like you say, sort of normalizing these conversations that not everything warrants these antibiotics, and humans don't necessarily visit doctors for the same reasons that we take our pets to the vets. And actually just familiarising, if it was the same case that if we were to go to our doctors for such an issue, their first line sort of medicine might not necessarily be an antibiotic. And that's not a bad thing.
Absolutely.
So in terms of building this evidence that we clearly need and the human side is really working on at the moment, how can we generate this evidence, and how can we define what the duration of our antibiotic courses should be?
Well, I think there's a few groups working on this, and certainly if you're living in Denmark, then there's a group working in there, and in America, there's another group who are trying to do some research there. But in the UK, we have started up a study called the Stop on Sunday trial, and the idea is we're trying to establish what is the optimal duration for antibiotic use to treat sporadic cystitis in female dogs. Because this is commonly a bacterial condition, and it merits antibiotic therapy in the majority of cases to resolve that. And sporadic cystitis, we think, probably accounts for 5 to 10% of presentations in unwell animals. So it's significant. It should be something that we see on a common basis in practice. And if dogs come in presenting any of the classic triad of lower urinary tract signs, polyuria, hematuria, dysuria or stranguria, there is a strong chance, probably over 60% chance, that they have a bacterial urinary tract infection. So I think that's a perfectly reasonable situation for you as a vet to reach for antibiotics. Now, we are trying to reflect what's going on in practice. So wherever you are presented with a dog in that situation, and it must be a female dog, and they must be between 6 months and 10 years of age. So if you're seeing those cases, and you make a decision that you're going to treat that dog with antibiotics, and if you want to do culture, that's fine, that's great. If you don't, then we accept them coming in even without those precautions because we want to reflect normal practice. The only thing that we're imposing is the duration of that antibiotic course. And we've tried to use a pseudo-randomization process because I don't want to make this any more complicated for vets who are busy anyway to get involved. So whatever day of the week you come in or the pet comes in, Monday to Friday, you design a course that finishes on Sunday evening. So on a Monday, that's going to be a 7-day course. On a Wednesday, a 5-day course. And on a Friday, that will be a 3-day course of antibiotics. And a few reasons for stopping on Sunday. One is because it's a nice way to get that range of treatment courses between 3 and 7 days. The second is we're mostly back at work on a Monday morning. And so that's an opportunity for safety netting. We ask pet owners to ring up and let you know how their dogs got on. And the answer that they should be telling you is fixed. They got better. Because if they didn't, after at least 48 to 72 hours of therapy, then something else might be going on. Maybe there's a stone go in there. Maybe there's another problem. Maybe there's you've picked the wrong antibiotic. So I think that's an opportunity for vets to reflect on what to do next, maybe to justify some further investigations to get to the bottom of it. But what you do on the Monday is absolutely up to you. So if you decide this is a daft idea, 3 days is never enough, I'm giving them another week's course, that's fine, up to you. We'll just record it and note that as a treatment failure and see if that stacks up, that we see that more often after 3 days compared to longer courses. Because we'd love to be able to say that 3 days is as good as 7 days, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's not quite as good. And we need to offer that evidence so that we can guide people to the best duration for treating dogs. So if it does turn out to be 4 days is better than 3 days, but no different from 7 days, we'll make that recommendation. And I should just add, we are using amoxiclav for this study. So we've recognised that that is the most commonly used antibiotic across Europe. And we felt that because it's so commonly available and it is a reasonable choice, albeit you could argue that the clavulanic acid is unnecessary, we felt that there were too few vets who used amoxicillin commonly. And therefore, we have started with amoxiclav. And what I really desperately need is vets in practice who are seeing these cases to get in touch, because we just need your help to recruit these cases, to get them enrolled when you see them, to give them that course and to let us know whether it worked or didn't work. And we're using an electronic data capture platform, something called CASTA, which is human grade, so lots of hospitals use it for their type of research, and it means that the data is anonymized, it's completely secure, there's no GDPR issues, and I guarantee that this is a low input study. So you do need to have a conversation with your owners. You do need to say, no one knows what the optimal duration is, so we're being part of this study to try and get that evidence, and are you happy to be involved? And you just need to collect the owner's email address, because we do send out a couple of surveys to owners just to get a further indication that they did all right with that treatment course. If you can send me an email, I will send you all the information you need. It contains consent forms for the owners, though as long as you get oral consent, that is fine. And it contains a little bit of information as to how the study works. We have published the study as a protocol, so it's all transparent. We are trying to be as scientifically rigorous as we possibly can, but I desperately, desperately need more people to help me get these cases, because we need large numbers to actually be able to say, hand on heart, this is a good, strong, robust evidence that we can rely on.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's going to take an industry-wide effort to be able to really make these things happen. And obviously, it's going to really help vets in their clinical decisions in practice. Just touching on that, in terms of what is required of the vets, because as we know, vets are incredibly busy people, hard to pin down in practice, already have 1,001 things to do. What is required of them in this process, or how much out of their consultation time are they looking at to be able to contribute to this?
I hope a minute at most. So I think it's relatively easy, because we're not actually changing anything that you do. So we are saying, okay, you've seen this case, you've made that decision. What you do around it is what you would do anyway. So we're not asking that people do any extra tests or any extra things. We just, you make the decision that this is a dog, female dog, right age, that merits antibiotic use for sporadic cystitis, and you're going to prescribe amoxiclav. And then when you're typing it into the computer, you just have to quickly mathematically work out how many doses I need to get me to Sunday. You need to have that conversation with the owner. You need to make sure that they're happy, that they're involved in this, and you need to collect their email address. And then either at that point, and it must be the same day, we really do need it to be the same day, you can input that data into Caster. And this is a brilliant platform because it's user-friendly, and you just have to input, I think, about 20 data points to get the dog enrolled, and then everything else will sort itself out. So I guess each case, adding in the data and checking that the owners are happy with it, probably adds 2-3 minutes to your consultation time. But if you're interested in it, I find clinical research really rewarding. I think that actually asking these questions generates new questions. It makes us challenge everything that we're doing in practice. Why do we use these medications in this way? We've done just because someone else did. Someone else thought it was a great idea 100 years ago. We want to find better and better ways to do veterinary medicine. We want to take the profession forward, and we need to do that together. And I'm a firm believer that primary care is where veterinary medicine happens. It is, they're seeing so many more cases than I will see working in a referral practice. And why should I, working in a completely different environment, come up with the answers for cases that are seen in primary care? It shouldn't be. It should be a reflection of the cases that are being treated in that situation. So that's the whole point of this study. It is a study that relies on vets working in primary care to generate the data to guide improved care in the future. So I hope it's fun. If anyone does enjoy it and they say, hang on, I've got other ideas, please let us know. I was involved in the Small Animal Medicine Society for the last few years, and Kirsty Rowe, who's now in charge, is still really encouraging vets with ideas about clinical research to get in touch, and let's mobilize so that we can work together to get good answers. And if any vet wants to be more part of the SOS study and they want to do some number crunching when we get to that stage, or contribute to manuscript preparation, more the merrier. Very, very much happy to welcome those people and work with them to try and get this to where it should be.
Wow, it sounds like an incredible opportunity to really get involved and play their part in combating this antimicrobial resistance. And I can only imagine it's going to be extremely inspiring to other vets to really sort of play their part, and perhaps for more studies to be done on different clinical cases and different antimicrobials, and really see where it goes from there. So we'll absolutely pop some links below just so that you guys listening have access to the study. And if you do really want to get involved with this, then we'll pop some links so that you can contact Fergus as well, if that's okay.
And I'm very grateful to all the vets that have already taken part. We have been up and running for a little while, and just welcome more vets involved, because the more people that are thinking about it, hopefully if every vet that was signed up could get me just two or three cases over the next 6 to 12 months, we'll be there. Okay, it's not a massive ask from any individual, but if we just get a few people to start building a few cases, then we'll be able to get some great data.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely get involved, people, because this is going to be really quite groundbreaking. Well, thank you so much for your time, Fergus. It's been lovely chatting with you and to hear about everything you've been up to. And best of luck with the study. It sounds like it's going really well. So I'm really excited to see what happens with that. And I'm sure we'll hear more from you in the run up to AMR week in November.
Sounds good. Thank you very much for the
chance. Thank you so much.
These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon.